Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we are going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. One of the ideas that motivates me in this show is that as human beings, even just as animals with central nervous systems, we have access to a wide variety of states of consciousness. And what happens, though, is that we need to find ways of making meaning of those experiences. And different cultures, different stories exist that transform those natural states into different meanings. So in one culture, it's widely held that dreams can be oracular, can tell you things about the future, can put you in contact with the spirits of the dead, and so more people who have the experience of dreaming will allow those experiences or have those experiences shaped for them. Where in our secular culture, a lot of people believe that dreams are just sort of noise of the previous day, meaningless blips in the neural frameworks with occasionally funny things that happen that are worth noting, like an odd thing you watched on television the night before. And if you have that frame of mind, then your states of consciousness or your altered states, the states of dream, will shape themselves that way as well. And I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to do with this show, is to open up the different ways in which we narrate and shape and frame the various kinds of consciousness that we encounter on a daily and sometimes much less frequent basis, especially when dealing with extraordinary states of experience. One extraordinary state that I had that reflects this thing about stories and different cultural frameworks very well is one time I was doing a yoga class. I started doing yoga like a lot of people in the sort of late 90s, turn of the 2000s, when it was really starting to get going again, and yoga will be the topic of today's conversation. And I was coming out of camel pose, Ustrasana, and I suddenly had this incredibly weird dream-like head rush that was more than a typical head rush. It had a sort of psychedelic quality to it. And it was really kind of striking, and after the class I went up to the yoga instructor and I said, look, I came out of Ustrasana and I had this really weird head rush. And he said, you know, he started talking about circulation of blood and how you have to be careful about, you know, blood rushing to your head, and it's this, there's certain kind of imbalances in the physical body and da-da-da. And I said, yeah, I understand all that, but I asked him, have you ever done nitrous oxide? It was kind of like doing nitrous oxide. It was like a, you know, it was kind of dreamlike and peculiar. And then he immediately went, oh, well, there are these energy circuits in the body, these esoteric systems called nadis, and they, you know, circulate the psychic energy. And so he's just switched registers from this physical description of what had been happening to me to this sort of psychic, esoteric description, that using terms that no science, you know, conventional scientist or biologist would really recognize. And for him, it was just two different ways of explaining a situation, but it really struck me both about how we frame our states of consciousness and our experiences, but also something very particular about yoga. And that's one of the things we'll be exploring today with our guest, Stephanie Simon, who has just come out with a book called The Subtle Body, A Story of Yoga in America. And she talks about, among other things, this dynamic that yoga has gone through between the secular and materialistic and the sacred and esoteric. But before we bring Stephanie on, I'd like to bring on our esoteric librarian, Maja Dau. How are you doing today, Maja?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Very good. You know, I know you're a huge fan of Mircea Eliade's book on yoga, and I'm just wondering if you could just provide from that vast store of esoteric tidbits that you carry around. What's something that strikes you as interesting about or important to remember about the topic of yoga before we embark?
Ooh, there's so many things I could pick out of there. Okay, that's a really good question, though. So one of my favorite big points that Mircea brings up throughout that whole book, Yoga and Immortality, is about how yoga is about freeing spirits inside your physical body. And to him, that's like the kind of precursor to immortality, is you let go the spirit inside of your flesh, right? And the yoga practices are what do that. And so, like, with your experience, what your teacher was telling you is that you, like, released a trigger point in your subtle body, the nadi system, which is, like, right, all these kind of pathways where the stuff circulates. And for most people, if you don't do, like, an actual activity or, like, a chant or some kind of thing to get them going, they're just kind of hanging out. They don't really do much. So one of the things that Eliade kind of discusses is how yoga can trigger those and basically, like, literally kind of release the spirit or consciousness or God, if you want to use that word, from inside the actual atoms that are, like, in your flesh. It's like when you have those trippy, dreamy experiences when you're doing yoga, it's kind of literally like spirit is getting manifested in your flesh at that exact moment, which, of course, is like that ideal of yoga. Most people think of it just as, like, exercise or whatever. But in yoga philosophy, it's literally like how to get God going on in your body.
Well, that's a great dynamic to start off with this playoff between the spirit and flesh, which we tend to polarize so much, probably needlessly. But with that, let's bring on Stephanie Simon. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Very good. Well, since we're talking about the personal experience at the moment, I'm kind of curious. I know you've practiced yoga for quite a long time. I'm curious whether there was some equivalent experience that you had where, I mean, I'm not sure why you started doing it initially, but there was probably some point where you went, wow, this practice really has something more going on to it than I had expected. And I assume there's probably some of those things have motivated your interest in researching and studying it as well as practicing it.
Well, I mean, I kind of wish I could say I had such a dramatic, you know, moment of revelation. Unfortunately, I feel like some people have a proclivity for those kinds of revelatory moments through just a physical practice, and I'm not one of them. So I kind of hope for that and know it's there in the practice, but have just experienced it more as just moving the energy through my body in a really powerful way, but not yet tipping me into really altered states of consciousness. I also believe that certain forms of the practice or certain aspects of it are more liable to do that than others, and pranayama, I think, is one of the most powerful ways of doing that, and particularly because in the kind of yoga I practice, pranayama isn't taught until you're much more advanced. I've very, very slightly dabbled in that and really haven't spent the time and energy on pranayama and meditation, where I think you really, if you're going after those experiences in a more deliberate way, you're more likely to have them there, although some people do just have them in an asana practice, certainly.
Sure, but there's a subtler form of it, too. I mean, even when you just talk about circulating energy through the body, and if you're raised in, you know, conventional framework of Western materialism and ideas about the body that come from doctors and whatever, that even the category of energy, which is widely used in all sorts of alternative therapies and spiritual practices, is sort of like, what does that mean? I mean, if you ask a hard-headed scientist, like, wow, I feel all this energy moving through my body,
right,
they're like, what are you talking about?
But
so how did that happen, too? Like, when you were practicing, there was like suddenly like, wow, there's something moving here that isn't just like blood or sweat or something that I have an obvious metaphor for.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what happens is it's for me, experienced more as it almost, because I am rooted in this secular scientific society, so it's hard to get away from. But I experience, I buy into on a certain level. Like I believe that those are good ways of talking about energy, the subtle body, as figured in yoga or qi in the Chinese alternative medicine, Chinese traditional medicine. But you know, for me, it's as practicing yoga is as powerful as any antidepressant or any mood enhancer that I've, you know, you could ever encounter. So I experience it as this just extremely reliable way of boosting your, you know, boosting and regulating your mood and creating a sense of vitality, which is counterintuitive to do like a sweaty, hard yoga practice, you know, and then feeling much, much more alive and awake, although I suppose people who exercise tend to believe in that as well.
Well, I was just going to say, can you, like, maybe differentiate that feeling from yoga as opposed to, like, a runner's high?
Although they're really similar. They are similar. I think the kind from yoga is a little bit smoother and more long-lasting is how I would differentiate them.
Mm.
But again, like, you know, I feel like I've had the privilege to, like, dip into this practice, but have not explored its depths, and partly like the timing for me too. I mean, this is a more pedestrian aspect of yoga, but yoga's a demanding path, and that's why actually Aldous Huxley didn't really like it very much. He thought it was too demanding for most people, and that's why he preferred psychedelics. Then I feel like, again, like some people can energetically are closer to like opening things up and moving the, you know, kundalini up their chakras. I definitely feel like I was like starting in way kindergarten, preschool of all that. And so, and then the moment I was kind of approaching really learning pranayama, I had my two kids, so, which I feel like is the opposite movement. And literally in labor, I felt like I was like, oh, this is kundalini going the other way. You know, Eric, when you mentioned that experience you had coming out of Ustrasana, I mean, the first thing I thought of was obviously the subtle body for obvious reasons, but I mean, there are a lot of people, some people don't even have to do yoga. I mean, they'll just be sitting in a hotel room or doing something kind of mundane and have this powerful rush and then later realize what it was or feel like yoga made sense of that feeling or that energetic movement.
Right. Well, so, one question is just why you decided to. I knew you've been working on this book for a long time, and I'm very happy that you finally got it out. Congratulations. And but I was intrigued by the title, The Subtle Body. I expected something more like, Yankee mystic or something. that you actually really wanted to focus on that idea of the subtle body. So could you just talk a little bit about that and why that ended up being your title and the kind of organizing idea for the book?
Well, I mean, I think yoga, if you take it seriously and you take its metaphysics seriously, it does challenge a lot of the way Americans think about reality. I mean, you know, as you said, you know, an ordinary doctor would say, what are you talking about, this energy moving through your body? And I think that's really important because I think that even though all these people, you know, practice asana and maybe not be so interested in the spiritual dimensions of so-called spiritual dimensions of yoga, yoga posits, you know, has a very different ontology than what we abide in. And I think that's, one, I think it's really fascinating, and I think it's a very convincing one in some ways. And I think people can lose sight of the way that yoga challenges us, you know, in its most basic assumptions about how things work. And I think when you look at its assimilation over time, the subtle body as a concept gets foregrounded or marginalized depending on which era and which teacher and what their agenda is. And so I felt like if you just traced how people talk about the subtle body within yoga, you would get a really good sense of like what pressures they were responding to in the culture and what they think their audience needed and, you know, what it took essentially to assimilate yoga. And certainly some of the time it took pretty much denying its metaphysics, and the people who were really big popularizers, particularly of hatha yoga, because it's, you know, hatha yoga is a very physical gateway into yoga and Indian philosophy, they tended to kind of ignore, not mention, or really kind of skip over the subtle body. But, you know, it went in cycles.
Well, it's very interesting to me that you say that like that, just because like you see the same thing happen in China, because a lot of people don't know, but the acupuncture meridians are actually based on the nadis, or the subtle body, from India. Like, they took all of those meridians from the nadis. Like, they picked certain ones. Uh-huh. But what ended up happening was there's these ones called, like, the extraordinary vessels, which are all, like, it's all, like, psychic energy and, like, very esoteric triggers that they trigger. Some acupuncturists that use it that way, like Mikio Sankey and people like that. But in China, they only put the focus on the ones that correlate specifically to organs. And then they eradicate all of the ancient research that goes into, like, the more psychic nature of them. And it becomes only about the physical phenomenon.
Well, one of the wonderful things I liked about your book, Stephanie, is the way you show how there's this fascinating oscillation in Hatha Yoga in America, between a very secular expression, stripped of metaphysics, stripped of even languages of energy that have any sort of esoteric dimension to them, and on the other hand, become the platform for full-blown religious formations and sort of devotional attitudes and sacred energies. And I was thinking about it. There's really nothing else like that that has become like a pivot point or a bridge or an oscillating, like almost like a weave between, like a way of like stitching these two different aspects of the American psyche. And it's a wonderful story. Could you just get like just historically maybe an example of one of those shifts, whether it's the one in the 70s or the 50s? I mean, you talk about a number of them, but...
Yeah. Well, I think one that's the most interesting, probably not as well known, because it happened before we were all alive, or many of us were alive, I suppose. You may have some older listeners, but is the one in the late 40s and early 50s. Because yoga, up to that point, had been primarily popularized by the Vedanta Swamis, like Swami Prabhavananda, an earlier Swami Vivekananda, but at that time, Swami Prabhavananda was up at the Hollywood Vedanta Center, and Swami Yogananda in Los Angeles, who had his base at Mount Washington in Los Angeles. And they did very much present yoga as a spiritual path. The Vedanta Society really made good use of Kundalini, but did not typically promote Hatha Yoga at all. And so people were really looking to yoga, and there were a lot of people looking to yoga, by the way, in America, even by the late 20s and 30s. The most available forms were of a more meditative and devotional sort. And then Yogananda's Kriya Yoga, which you can't really learn unless you're initiated, but he had dropped asanas and a sort of really physical component pretty early on. But then people, were starting to grab, I mean, there certainly was Hatha Yoga being taught, and it did get a lot of attention, particularly the people associated with Pierre Bernard, but it really didn't permeate out around the country so much until the late 40s, and one of the people who really were responsible for that was Indra Devi, and she, as many people may know, she is an immigrant. She has Russian-Swedish background, but she had been an expatriate all her life in various countries, in India, in China, in Germany, fleeing Russia in her youth. And so when she got to America, and by the way, she studied with one of the most famous Hatha Yoga masters in the 20th century, Krishnamacharya. She studied with him in India for not very long in the 30s, and was like one of the first white women to do so, for sure. He almost refused to teach her until she had the Raj of Mysore intervene on her behalf. She was extremely well-connected wherever she went. So she came to Los Angeles in 1947. It's the post-war era. L.A. is booming. Population is increasing dramatically. And she starts teaching, and she quickly, between the Huxleys, who she befriended quickly, and Paul Bragg, who was a big health promoter, who you may still find Bragg's amino acids or cider vinegar. He was a big health advisor to the stars. So Indra Devi quickly amassed a celebrity following, and then as now, when celebrities did yoga, it was worthy of writing about in the press. So you got lots of stories about Gloria Swanson doing yoga and Jennifer Jones and Olivia de Havilland. But what Debbie did, though, she herself was extremely devoted yoga practitioner and very devoted to all its dimensions. She did not skimp in her, you know, spiritual ideas about yoga in any way, and in fact became a follower of Sai Baba later on. She said, you know, look, yoga's for health and beauty and keeping yourself young. And you know, she basically wrote a very well-selling book called Forever Young, Forever Healthy, and it was based on Hatha Yoga, but she kind of took it almost completely out of any sort of system of limbs or bodily purification, and it was really this kind of health treatise that presented Hatha Yoga as a way to stay healthy and beautiful. And she, I think at that time, she basically takes yoga and says, you know, really you need a guru to learn the spiritual stuff. So when I talk about yoga, I'm just going to talk about the poses. So at that moment, she contracted yoga down to actually the poses themselves and really kind of did away with almost everything else except for maybe a little bit of breathing. And she had pictures of movie stars in her book, you know, practicing and lovely ladies and, you know, that looked pretty made up, actually, in leotards on shag carpet doing cobra pose. And it, you know, it kind of catapulted her, that and, you know, her association with Hollywood and her books kind of catapulted her into being the first lady of yoga, she was called. And then she did another book called Yoga in America. And so it was extremely secularized. And I believe Debbie was important. And there were other teachers who were doing the same. She wasn't the only one. There was a woman named Claire Stewart who was teaching yoga in the same circles, actually, in L.A. at the time. But I think Debbie, because she had been an outsider wherever she went for her entire life, I think she was very good at discerning what a culture could tolerate in terms of the esoteric dimension of yoga at that moment. And in her next book, which came out in 1959, she actually gives a 3-page discussion of the subtle body. And what's interesting is that that is a year after Aldous Huxley wrote this big piece in the Saturday Evening Post, and essentially promoting psychedelics, which he called mind manifestors. And this is the Saturday Evening Post, and he pretty much says everyone should do them, including acid, and because they give you this powerful spiritual experience. And he said, yoga can give it to you too, but yoga is too hard for most people. So this is the way. And he said in 1958, he said there's going to be a religious revival based on these substances, and it will probably be a religious revolution. So that was happening in the late 50s. So Debbie kind of sensed the tide shifting already. And so, you know, by the time the hippies came around, I mean, the material for their religious revolution was there, and it had been kind of delivered to them through these middle-aged people in Los Angeles. You know, and in Debbie's case...
One question I've always had about the that period, when the health and beauty yoga school of that period, were they, how intensely were they focused on the breath in the sense that in holding a pose you would be breathing a certain number of times or being breathing in a certain way, or was this breath side of it even just in a technical way kind of left to the side?
You know, I think
it's hard to find out.
It's hard to find out, but actually, I think the answer is there. It might not have been as audibly the focus, but I actually think it was, and for two reasons. The way Debbie talks about it, when you listen to her records of the era, one, and because she was a student of Krishnamacharya, too, she learned the breath very well. And finally, she would go into local, like, gyms and beauty, what they called beauty salons, which were places where women worked out, and she watched the people, and they were all doing things that looked a lot like yoga. And she said, that's yoga. They don't realize that's yoga, these poses that they're doing. They think it's just calisthenics. But the difference is the breath. So she distinguished herself and her system really because, one, she understood that it came from yoga because it was yoga, and because she knew the breathing that was so crucial.
One of the other things that we've been throwing around, I think, a little loosely here, and that you have to address in your book and do well, is this term yoga. It's like, I mean, of course, you know, if you go into the history of it or whatever, it's a very complicated story, but it's this strange thing where for most of us, we just say yoga and we think of hatha yoga. We know there's some philosophy, but really it's about this like series of physical practices within a more or less kind of spiritual self-help kind of framework. And yet, when you look at, even just as a historian, if you're going to be talking about the history of yoga in America, you have to talk about these other streams where people were using the term and using the underlying metaphysics, but not necessarily promoting the physical movements, the asanas. So how did you deal with that when you not just in terms of explaining the difference, but also in terms of organizing what yoga means in American history?
Yeah, that was like one of the biggest challenges of writing this kind of book too, is to give the reader some insight into that and not get bogged down in boring explanation. And so, I mean, basically, the basic situation is there are many types of yoga, and yoga is not even limited to Hinduism. And so I wanted to make sure people understood, and what I discovered was that, you know, Hatha Yoga, the system that puts the most emphasis on the physical body and that was where the poses come from, was just one of many kinds of yoga that came from India, and that once here, then we then did, you know, further creatively adapted it. But it was often, but there's no kind of like pure yoga that is kind of unaffected. I mean, historically, if you look at how even Hatha Yoga developed in the 20th century, some scholars make a fairly convincing case that it may have borrowed from Western systems of physical culture. And so similarly, you know, something like Shivananda Yoga, taught by a guru in India in the early 20th century and taught here now today, there's Hatha Yoga, but they teach other dimensions of it. So I always wanted to try to be very precise about explaining, like, which practices were being taught and where the emphasis lay, because that also caused a lot of actual conflict, either within organizations or with yoga teachers kind of reacting to other forms of yoga that were already present in America in presenting their own. And so, you know, just an example of this is when you get this sort of real boom of yoga in the 60s and 70s with gurus coming, and each kind of teaches a slightly different flavor. Some of them have poses or borrow from Hatha Yoga or incorporate Hatha Yoga. Some of them don't. There's a whole kind of set of yoga teachers who come up who are teaching a pretty straightforward Hatha Yoga, really influenced by BKS Iyengar. And they were very clear that they needed to distinguish themselves from that other stuff, which seemed to require that you pack up and move to the ashram and follow your guru around.
Yeah, so in a way that the term itself is representing the constantly shifting, constantly renegotiated boundaries of the thing itself. It's slippery. It's such a slippery term, and it's fascinating that like almost diametrically opposed impulses and desires and experiences even have been yoked to that to that term.
For someone who was schooled in literary criticism, it's kind of not. It's just kind of, well, of course yoga is fairly empty of meaning until people pour something into it. But I think for most people, that is a little bit harder to grasp. But yeah, it is constantly shifting. But you know, I kind of feel like it must be. I don't know so much about it. Kind of like Talmudic scholarship. You know, each layer of commentary brings its own set of references and, you know, historical shadings. I mean, it's true of yoga, except it's all happening. It can be happening simultaneously.
Right.
That kind of what the word means gets layered. You know, it draws on so many sources, both scriptural and contemporary, and it does shift around. And
well,
often
it's pretty
not
interesting
anyway.
To me, too, just because one of the things that Eliade examines in his book is the distinction between shamanism and yoga. When you go back into, like, the super-duper ancient yoga stuff, I mean, it's kind of difficult to differentiate it from shamanism. And I think it's kind of funny just because you do have all this Huxley coming and saying, like, oh, you can just do, you know, psychedelics instead of yoga. And it's like, but then if you go way back, like, you know, shamans that were doing psychedelics and yoga and, like, all this kind of stuff, it was all done kind of together in a lot of places. It wasn't one or the other. So that kind of definition and distinction of what exactly is yoga, is it some kind of physical practice? Is it blah, blah, blah? But one of the things he kind of distinguishes it as, Eliade, is a navigation of ecstatic states and altered states
right.
of consciousness.
Right.
And that as if long as that is the kind of underlying definer, then you can apply that to philosophies, to mental experiences, to breathing, to physical things, and it kind of covers a lot of ground.
So I think that that's probably true. I mean, if you look at all the different systems, they're so diverse. What they share is kind of the state of consciousness they want to get you to.
Right.
Or, you know, or succeed in doing so. But I think what's also interesting is to what degree the teachers themselves are rhetorically attached to tradition, so they have to constantly talk about their yoga. Well, you see this in the 20th century, like, some of them really want to insist on their, like, that they are presenting a totally pure facsimile of what happened before, the thing that was taught before, in an unbroken lineage. And so, people like Prabhupada, I think, was along those lines, saying, you know, this is what they taught centuries, millennia ago. But someone like Maharshi Mahesh, kind of didn't even want people to call his system yoga. He called it TM, Transcendental Meditation. But it was really clear what he was teaching was a form of yoga.
Right.
So the issue, and it's also interesting, that issue of the psychedelics done simultaneously to yoga, because that even here we went through a moment where people were kind of combining them in the actual act of experiencing them. But then I think that, I mean, that as being the dominant kind of understanding of yoga, or even one of the dominant ones, has certainly faded.
Well, I want to ask you a question more about the history, the idea of tradition and ancient lineage in the construction of yoga. But before we do that, I want to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're talking with Stephanie Simon, author of The Subtle Body, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent news.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Wonder why some people have successful lives? Well, let's shrink about this. Hi, I'm Dr. Molly Barrow, author of Matchlines for Singles and the Malia and Teacup Self-Esteem Building Series for Children. Please join me and my guests every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to explore psychological and practical problem solving, from personal issues to world events. You can call in to join the conversation or just enjoy listening. If you're looking for balance in your relationship, career choices, family, and your planet, please join Dr. Molly Barrow and Shrink About This Tuesday at 10 Eastern on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking with Stephanie Simon, author of The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. So, Stephanie, one of the questions I have for you is that in almost all the sort of ways I've heard people talk about yoga, particularly students, but a lot of teachers in class, is they often emphasize this the ancient tradition, this ancient path, this long-standing. So there's a very strong, even if it's not claimed as being a specific lineage, there's a sort of general sense that there's this continuous, unbroken stream of practice that leads to this moment. And that's clearly something that people, one of the draws, is not just that this is a practice that you can do now that has these results, even deeply spiritual results, but it's the idea that you're kind of tapping into some ancient way, and yet when you look at the information and you look at the scholars and how they're drawing things, like it's like you say that there's some evidence that there are calisthenics and even some British soldier moves embedded and mixed in with the kinds of postures that we now consider to be hatha yoga. How does that work? What is your feeling about that? About the need for that story of a tradition? Do you feel that in telling the story, is your story really about such a continuity ultimately, or do you find that you see yoga more now as sort of something that's constantly breaking down and changing and becoming something else?
That's a good question. I think that as humans, we like to be embedded in a tradition. It's very comforting to feel like we are, you know, part of this human history and culture that goes back so far, and that it's reassuring. It seems to say, well, this must work if people have been doing it for thousands of years. And so I think tradition in that context really is kind of a way to allay doubts that you may have, and a faith builder, essentially. I do think yoga has probably been reinvented many times, and yet because, you know, my friend and teacher Eddie Stern pointed out, and I agree with him, that you know, the body has certain parameters, the human body. I mean, we've only had two legs and two arms for a long time now. And so there is potentially, and you know, I think, or plausibly, a sort of grammar of the body, a sort of Chomskyan grammar of the body, if you will, that kind of there are just some things that have gotten some results over time, which is why you will find such similar moves in calisthenics and yoga and gymnastics. They may have at one time come from the same source, or they may just be the, you know, what people discover when they start to work with their body. So, you know, I think in that sense, even though there's a certain amount of creative destruction in yoga, that it resolves around some common things over and over again, and the breath is one of them. And certainly in this era, I think we are most attached to a very elaborated asana system. And I think part of that has to do we're more urban and more sedentary than any culture that came before us. So it may just be that we need that more. But I don't know. I don't see that as a bad thing, because I think that while the Indian tradition has really foregrounds lineage, you know, upholding lineage and being very fastidious about lineage, you know, yoga was transmitted orally from guru to disciple, and so there's probably always been a lot of innovation and creativity there. We just don't necessarily have access to it. And so I think a lot of the nervousness about innovation has to do with feeling like we're going so far afield. All of that said, you know, the yoga today that is most common in gyms and health centers, it's not very complete, you know. It's just, in my mind, it's it's really an asana practice, and it leaves out much of the other stuff, and that's understandable. Most people who practice yoga don't have the time to spend 3 hours a day on a full-blown spiritual practice, which starts with bodily purifications and ends with, like, a deep meditation. That's just not practical for most people. And I don't think it was true of in the Indian tradition. It wasn't like, you know, common people were practicing yoga all over the place. Yogis had a special status in society, and it wasn't always a positive one, even.
Well, that's one of the interesting things to me, is that the lineages are literally things that were figured out by single individuals that were, like, doing it all day long. It's just like any other art where someone's, like, totally immersed in it, and they make some kind of crazy genius discovery. That's literally, like, where the yoga lines come from. And then people that do it for, like, 20 minutes a day, they don't even have their minds there to think they can. But one of the things that I think precludes people from making yoga innovations is the emphasis on lineage, where they're, like, not so much in the East, but in the West, they're instructed that this is the way you do it. So almost like their minds are closed to the fact that any other kind of experience might happen. And that's why you get, like Eric had, where he experiences something really weird and then tries to go up to his, you know, little yoga teacher and be like, what just happened? I mean, you got a really good answer. But I think a lot of people, because they're told, like, if they're in a Bikram yoga class and then they have some crazy experience, like, they won't even have some kind of creative context for it to realize that that could be going on. So it's good, because there is that grammar for the body that says, look, you do this and this and this, and you get this. But then there can be all of this other stuff that happens, too, and then there's no kind of parameter for it.
I'm glad you brought up a Bikram mantra, because I want to ask Stephanie about that. I mean, Bikram yoga is sort of known for being very kind of plug and play. You walk in there, and there's this hot and sweaty room, and there's mirrors everywhere, and there's very little religious or sacred iconography. In fact, it looks like a kind of aerobics class. It seems sort of narcissistic and kind of intense. And Bikram himself is, you know, extremely wealthy guy, and he did all this stuff with, you know, celebrities in L.A., and he tried to copyright his sequence of moves. And so in some ways, if you want to have an example of kind of modern corporate copyrighted yoga, people will talk about Bikram and kind of denigrate him. But you had a really interesting reading of the spiritual component or the spiritual appeal of Bikram yoga at the end of your book, which really was an eye-opener for me. I expected the usual kind of anti-Bikram harangue that you get from a lot of yogis who don't like him or don't think the system is very, very well-rounded. So talk a little bit about that, because that really gets to the heart of these issues about the body and spirituality and practice today.
Yeah, well, you know, I think I kind of love Bikram because he frustrates your desire for yoga. Like, I think we want yoga to, you know, we want the people teaching it to be a certain way, and he clearly refuses to be that way. But at the same time, what his system really demands, and I argue this also of Patabi Joyce's system, is it is so physically demanding that you pretty quickly realize you can't just go to Bikram yoga occasionally, drop in here and there, maybe a couple times a week. Like, you are committed pretty much the moment you set foot in there to either play by his rules and really take it on or not. And so I feel like what happens is it's this kind of act of truth, and you have to all of a sudden decide, well, I'm going to dedicate myself to this thing every day or most days a week, you know, for real. And it's 90 minutes a day. It's a non-trivial time commitment for most Americans. And so I think what you get, and it's true that it's a very body-centered practice, and he doesn't have any spiritual rhetoric that I can detect, and it's kind of almost anti-spirituality. But the act of committing to his system is one that you have to be pretty pious about. And so, nor does it preclude, really, in this day and age in America, delving into any other dimension of yoga if you get serious about that, too. Because, by the way, I mean, there's so much yoga media and there's so many other teachers. But more interestingly, really, is the fact that all of a sudden you have to orient yourself around this practice. And what that means is making sure you have the time for it. What that means, in all likelihood, is that you're all of a sudden not doing a lot of things you might do as your, you know, average American. Anything from, you know, eating junk food to watching a lot of TV, because you have to create the space for this practice. So in a way, Bikram yoga students are more devout in some way, at least to his system, and it may well. I mean, you know, it's really tempting to judge others. You know, while he doesn't emphasize the energetic movements of the subtle body, he certainly now teaches that in his teacher training, and it may well be that his students experience that. But at the very least, they've made a huge commitment to yoga as they understand it, and a bigger one than most people. And so I feel like Bikram and Patabi Joyce, in a way, brought back a certain level of devotion and sacrifice. And it starts in this very bodily rooted practice. But I think it's hard not to believe that some number of those people are really deeply transformed and move well beyond that. Because I just think that when you're playing with those energies, they go places.
Yeah, one of the fantasies I have is I like imagining a, you know, like a TV series or something about some very ordinary, you know, middle class, mundane person who just turns to yoga because whatever, that's, you know, just happenstance, it's at their gym and they kind of like it and they start to get, you know, just immediate payback. It feels good and they feel like they're sexier and they're not as stressed out and they're totally not interested in the spiritual dimension. And then something happens, either a specific event or just over time, you know, until the point where they're like, oh my God, I've become a hippie, or you know, they
right.
or they almost like yeah. it, rather than seeking the spirituality, which like it, living in the Bay Area, everywhere I go, I see it's everything is packaged with this sort of spiritual intent. There's probably all sorts of very interesting stories, and probably in some ways the most interesting stories are people who have approached it as a secular practice and then find themselves, to you know, against their own wishes to some degree, or at least their own
yeah.
intentions, transformed.
Well, but
oh, yes.
then the thing that I have to think is, how do you distinguish something like Bikram yoga, which is all physical and they have an experience like that, like, you know, feeling good and stuff. How would you say that that is separate from like going to a 1-hour jazzercise class every day? Like, is that, are people that have, you know, that physical experience in jazzercise and then feel good, like, is that the same as doing the Bikram yoga, or is it different?
Here's what I think. Because it's called Bikram yoga, that if they have that experience and start to get curious about it, they may just find themselves, or if they go to Bikram teacher training, because he now teaches the subtle body and the, you know, subtle anatomy in his teacher training, they have a whole different vocabulary to access to explain that experience and to perhaps deepen it. If you go to jazzercise, you are working your chakras and your nadis in jazzercise. I mean, of course you are. You can't not, right? It's
right.
just they don't take on that framework to describe what they're doing. So you, in all likelihood, even if you feel fantastic, you wouldn't say, oh, I just, you know, my kundalini is rising through my chakras. I mean, to explain it in any way, or I'm clearing out my nadis, I'm purifying my nadis. It just, it's not part of the discourse around the activity, so that it's sort of more self-contained.
Whereas so it's all like perception-based.
Yeah, so yeah. by saying this is yoga, and you can say that none of those, you know, very few of the poses you do in Bikram yoga do you see in the, you know, in the scriptures. I mean, you know, and you can say that of lots of classes, but it sort of like attaches itself then to this tradition of energetic movement, which is linked directly to, you know, highly blissful states of consciousness and apprehending divinity, you know. So I think that's why people like yoga so much, because they can, it gives them room. It gives them room to understand their experience in a different way and in a deeper way, and it creates this huge area of possibility. And, Eric, the story you described about this ordinary person who goes to yoga because their back hurts and then body, I mean, that story has happened millions of times. It pretty much happened to me. It's just I haven't succeeded in really, you know, feeling those more ecstatic states. And it happened to Lillian Follis, who had this show on TV and that started out in Cincinnati, Ohio, and went national really quickly in the 70s, mid-70s. I mean, that story is repeating itself again and again. And I think it's funny, because I think in places like the Bay Area, it is drowned out. But everywhere else, it's like, you know, people have to blog about it. And you see, and I think many yoga teachers probably start out that way, you know, not necessarily knowing they're inclined that way, but stumbling into it because now it's so available, and lo and behold, they're steered away from their original path, whatever it may be.
Yeah, it's a funny one. In a way, it seems like potentially a more honest and authentic route to let it emerge from the practice itself. I mean, again, from a kind of a Bay Area perspective, it's often kind of too much. You know, you can kind of see the way that teachers feel pressure to create a kind of spiritual pattern around what the practice is, and it doesn't necessarily come from their own experience, or they're not really up for it, or they don't really know what to say, and so it ends up just being this kind of miasma of inauthenticity that sort of puts people off from what the opportunity, or at least puts people like me off from what's the opportunity of the actual practice.
Right.
And what you were talking about with Bikram and Ashtanga, which I think is really key, is that part of the transformative aspect of the thing, which makes it a little different than something like jazzercise, is that there's a conscious devotion and commitment to the practice itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of practice, which you can also look at in American Zen's relationship to meditation, which often just talks about just practicing, just sitting, not with a lot of metaphysical overlay. There's something, there's a key there that I think works for Americans very well because it appeals both on a kind of secular, immediate, bodily, obvious level, and yet it really has a devotional component, but it's not one that involves explicit imagery or gods or
right.
And so that seems to me a very important key for not just yoga but for a lot of spiritual practices that use the body.
Yeah, and the other thing though is what's interesting, it kind of then immediately, if you're a self-aware person, it can set up this kind of internal dialogue that you kind of have to understand your relationship to the practice pretty quickly. Like, well, I'm practicing today but I'm not practicing today, like what's going on here, you know, like what are the obstacles I'm throwing up before myself to practice, and then, but also, you know, it then also speaks to, I think, one of the challenges of engaging in these types of disciplines and practices, which is they're time expensive, you know. So, unless you live in the Bay Area, which it's kind of expected you're engaged in something like that, I think, you know, and just to get back to what I saw in looking at the story over time, is the teachers that succeeded. Bikram being an interesting exception because the system is really demanding of time, but the systems that have succeeded most or the teachers who succeeded most, you know, often were the ones who would kind of make yoga something you could dip into and out of and, you know, come and go, and so it didn't require that level of devotion. And so I think Bikram and Joyce, you know, to their credit, have managed to create or promote a system that really is demanding of a huge amount of commitment and devotion, and yet, you know, have amassed pretty substantial followings. But I think that's also this kind of pivot point too with these things, is how in our secular American society that does not have a tradition of contemplation, how do you make space in your own life for these types of practices?
Well, sure, it's like TM was, what, 20 minutes a day?
Yeah, right, and TM is a great example of a quick one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think two times a day, but, you know, who's counting?
So how do you see that changing now, or where do you see that going? Do you have a sense, you know, one of the virtues of history is sometimes you can kind of catch a wave, and even intuitively you can kind of sense, like, okay, we're riding this wave now, it's kind of an expanding moment, is it going to contract, is it going to transform?
Yeah.
What how do you sense things shifting now, even compared to the mid-90s?
Well, one thing is, you know, I think what happens, yoga got so popular and people want to continue doing it despite changes in their own life. And I'm, like, most aware of the kid changes because I have two kids under five. So what I saw, interestingly, and I think it's pretty recent, is Express Yoga at one of the yoga centers in town in New York, which is an hour, and I've seen it in a couple places, which is, like, an hour long instead of an hour and a half. You know, so it's clearly like yoga had gotten so popular that they were now bowing to pressure of students that just couldn't do the longer class. So that's interesting to me as a kind of just trend. And the other thing is meditation is not being much of a focus, and pranayama is not being a focus, is clearly part of the current trend. Where it's going, you know, it's so assimilated
I keep feeling like we're headed for a contraction, but then I'm wrong. What may happen? I mean, there's certainly room for yet again more of an emphasis on a meditative practice, and you see that popping up here and there. But I tend to think that even if you get kind of a little bit more of a resurgence of a more fully spiritualized yoga, the 60s were a really interesting exception, but it tends to attract fewer people because, you know, that embodied experience is so powerful, and I think, the meditative one is much subtler. So, you know, I suppose you could say we're in the corporate yoga moment, and that's bound to, like, any franchise. Like, there are very few McDonald's of this world that last for, 90 years, and they're still, or whatever it is now, and are still going strong 70 years.
One other dimension of our corporate yoga moment is, and you don't emphasize it as much in the close of your book, is just the sort of celebrity status of many current yoga teachers and the amount of money involved. I mean, it's really actually kind of an extraordinary business. I started going to a local yoga studio when it just opened, and so I got to watch it, and I knew the owners, watch it transform, and it was really a remarkable story. I mean,
yeah.
they were riding the wave, but it's also, at the end of the day, it's an empty room with, very little overhead that you fill with people who are willing to pay, $15, $18, $20 bucks a pop. And so it's actually a really good business. And at some point, money is corrosive.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm curious how you see, is that kept in balance? Has it really changed things? Is there even a counter reaction to that, the kind of money that people can make, the kind of success that people have had?
Well, one thing you also see are free classes now and donation-only classes, and that's certainly, I think, in reaction to the, pricey yoga class and also the economic downturn and, the feeling that, it's kind of weird that this thing that's supposed to be so transformative spiritually is so expensive and exclusive in that way. That is sort of a unique thing about this moment in terms of the Hatha yoga, although in the 60s and 70s, and even Yogananda in the 20s and 30s was amassing a considerable wealth to his organization in any case. You saw that with the sort of things that culty things that grew up at the same moment in yoga, as Yogananda was kind of emerging in Los Angeles, these I Am movement. I mean, people, if you want to make a lot of money in this country, tell people how they should be doing things is one of, my mantras right now. It just seems like the people who succeed might not have a product or an art or a craft, but they can tell you how you should live your life. And, I mean, obviously, I think yoga is more than that. But can and does money corrupt? Certainly. Have yoga teachers succumbed to that? Absolutely. In terms of reaction, I think you do see it already in terms of a kind of a talk around yoga. But, I mean, part of the problem or the, and certain teachers have sort of, somebody like Rodney Yee certainly kind of rode up on the wave and hugely successful and is still quite successful, but then was subject to various very public allegations of sexual misconduct and got the New York Magazine piece about him or whatever. I think as a culture we do that with people that we find powerful or who are good at what they do and willing to, on some level, take it on.
I think that also goes back to what Eric was talking about earlier with how the yoga teachers feel pressure that they have to become this certain way because of the affiliation. Like, that's what happens to the gurus. Like, they can't be real people that, like to have sex. They're now a yoga guru. So they're, pure and saintly, even though, yoga gurus are, in India, totally not pure and saintly. But
So Stephanie, is there any, we've got to close now. Is there anywhere that people can look online for stuff you've written or stuff about the book?
Yeah, on my website, thesubtlebody.net. So that's where you can find, and the book is all over the place, Amazon, everywhere. But it's thesubtlebody.net, and
well,
I post events, et cetera. Everything's there.
Wonderful. Well, good luck with your book tour, and I'm very happy that I have an early advanced galley which has a picture of Marilyn Monroe doing a boat pose on the cover, which is, unfortunately you weren't able to use for the real book, so I feel extra special proud. And but thanks a lot for being on Expanding Mind. You've been listening to us here, Eric Davis and Maja Daou on Progressive Radio Network. Keep your minds open.